content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Reader's Digest with some bonus content from the Saturday Evening Post as well. Our first article is from Drama in Real Life, Last Ditch Effort. The 13-year-old skateboarder had been missing for 3 days. Then, a sharp-nosed hero picked up the trail, by Eric Raskin. Daryl follows a particular routine when it's time to get to work. He gets into his gear, loosens up for a few seconds, and takes a seat. Then a coworker grabs a shoe and shoves it into Daryl's face. Oh, by the way, Daryl is a dog. He's a Bloodhound, specifically. So sticking his snout deep into a sneaker is standard practice when the humans he works with at Farmington, Missouri Correctional Center's canine unit need him to track someone down. On a blazing hot day last July, at the edge of a ravine about 60 miles south of St. Louis, 6-year-old Daryl was given one of the most important jobs of his life. He had to find a 13-year-old boy named Dakota Cody Trinkle Jr. The boy had been missing for more than 3 days, and his mom and stepdad, Stephanie and Jared Neely, were frantic with worry. Authorities believed Cody might be somewhere in that deep wooded ravine, but time was running out for him if he didn't have food or water. So Stephanie provided one of her son's most pungent sneakers, and Lieutenant Joe Gillum, the leader of the canine unit, let Daryl smell it. Then he gave the command, "Find." Daryl took off running. Sunday, July 27, 2025, began like any other summer day for Cody, with his brothers, Stephen, 12, and Parker, 7, under the watchful eye of his grandmother, Martha Askins. She often watched the boys while his mom, a corrections officer at the Missouri Department of Corrections, worked a 12-hour shift. Askins lives in an unincorporated gated community called Goose Creek Lake. Whenever Cody was there, his routine was to ride his skateboard to his friend Sam's house on the other side of the 2,500-acre development, and hang out there for much of the day. Around 9 a.m., Cody had set out across town on his faded gray board, decorated with a purple graffiti monster. A few seconds later, security cameras outside the firehouse near the entrance to the community recorded the 5'6", 170-pound teenager skating by, decked out in a greenish-blue Harry Potter T-shirt and a black-and-white flat-brimmed ball cap over a mop of curly black hair. "I remember skating past the firehouse," Cody says. He doesn't remember what happened after that, and there's no further security footage to help fill in the timeline. As best as anyone can guess, he skated for another 15 minutes or so before heading down a hill on Wren Drive to a T-intersection with Bluebird Drive, which was on the edge of a ravine. It seems that Cody lost control of his skateboard, hit some tall grass on the other side of the intersection, flew off his board, and tumbled down a steep incline into the ravine. Did he lose consciousness fully? Nobody knows. He certainly hit his head. Cody apparently had periods of partial consciousness, because he stripped off some of his clothes and crawled into deeper shade to escape the July heat, ending up about 250 yards from the road. It would be about another 9 hours before anyone even realized he was missing. Cody typically came home from Sam's about 4 p.m, in plenty of time for dinner. When he didn't, Askins began to wonder what was up. Cody didn't have his cell phone with him, so at 6 p.m. she called Sam's house. "Hey, is Cody coming home anytime soon?" "He isn't here," Sam said. "He never made it today." Sam had assumed that his friend had found something else to do. When Sam and Askins realized that neither of them had seen Cody all day, Askins called the Francois County Sheriff's Department, then Stephanie. "You need to call me immediately," Stephanie heard her mother say on her voicemail when she finished her shift at 7 p.m. "Cody's not home," Askins told her daughter when they finally connected. "What do you mean?" "Cody went to his friend's house, and his friend says he never showed up, and he hasn't called us back, and we don't know where he is." That's not like Cody, Stephanie thought. Her son was a creature of habit. He followed the same schedule every day. She drove straight to her mom's, where officers from the sheriff's department were gathering details and filling out a report. They suspected that Cody might have run away. Stephanie knew in her bones that was not a possibility. Either somebody kidnapped him or he's lying dead in a ditch somewhere, she thought. So she set out to find him. Stephanie and her mom drove up and down every street in Goose Creek Lake in Askins' truck, while Jared searched the neighborhood on his motorcycle. But it was getting dark. There was only so much they could do. Stephanie's sister, Brittany Van Volkenberg, is a volunteer firefighter for the Goose Creek Lake Fire Department. And Monday morning, about 24 hours after Cody was last seen, Stephanie called on her to organize a search team from the firehouse. Van Volkenberg rallied her team. "I said, this is my nephew. We need to get a search team together." And everyone was immediately on board, she later told the local NBC News affiliate. The search party, made up of nearly 50 firefighters and local residents, conducted a grid search. Some went off-road in all-terrain side-by-sides. Some rode motorcycles. Some walked arm-in-arm through the woods. They looked just about everywhere they could, but didn't realize that to find Cody, they'd have to hike deep into the wooded ravine off Bluebird and Wren. Jared and Askins took care of the two younger boys, while Stephanie and her sister led the search. As the hours and then days passed, Stephanie was determined not to let panic overtake her. "Me sitting on my butt crying is not going to help anything," she thought. Meanwhile, the sheriff's office received reports that Cody had been seen two towns over. Stephanie never bought any of that. She felt sure he was somewhere in Goose Creek Lake. He had to be. She also understood that wasn't necessarily a good thing. "I knew the statistics," Stephanie says. "The longer it went on, the more I had to kind of wrap my brain around that we may not be finding Cody. We may be finding a body." On Wednesday, July 30, a little past 9:30 in the morning, Askins jumped in her truck for another desperate pass down the same roads they'd been over countless times. Her grandson, Stephen, sat in the back, his eyes peeled. "Stop!" Stephen suddenly yelled. There, in tall grass near the intersection of Bluebird and Wren, sat Cody's skateboard with its distinctive purple graffiti monster. They sped back to Askins' house to get Stephanie and Jared. Stephanie will never forget what she saw when she arrived on the scene. The nose of the skateboard was pointing down toward the ravine, she says. It was almost literally like the universe was telling us, "He's right here." Jared and Stephanie slid down into the ravine, which was slick from the previous night's rain. The terrain was rough. Large boulders, loose rocks, oak trees, and thick undergrowth. And they couldn't see Cody anywhere. Before they went any farther, they called the sheriff's department and were instructed to wait for officers to arrive with their canine unit. But St. Francois County's dogs are German Shepherds and Belgian Malinois, neither of which can track older scents the way bloodhounds do. So a call went out to Joe Gillum at the Farmington Correctional Center. He already knew about the missing local boy. He also knew that his dogs had never found anyone when the trail had gone so cold. "Look, I'm not going to make any promises," Gillum told the county officer on the phone. "This is like a three-day-old track. But with finding the skateboard, we have a place to start. So we're going to do everything we can to get to Cody home." Gillum gathered a team, 6 people in all, and assessed which of his 5 bloodhounds would be best suited for the situation. It was clearly a job for Darryl, who worked well in hot weather and on older tracks, and was great in thick vegetation. When they arrived a little over an hour later, Gillum and his crew took a quick look around, staying out of the ravine to avoid creating more scents for Darryl to sort through. Stephanie was waiting with Cody's sneakers. Darryl was fitted into his harness. Ready to go to work, he sniffed one of the shoes and heard that magic word, find. Gillum and 2 members of his team stayed at the command post at the top of the ravine, with Cody's family nearby. Canine handler Lieutenant Chris Marshall and the 2 others from the team went with Darryl. Within minutes, Darryl found his way to the edge of the ravine and repeatedly stuck his neck out, an indicator that he had picked up a scent he liked. After that, he was off. Down the steep 15-foot drop, the canine unit members literally sliding down behind him. Gillum and the others lost sight of the rescuers as soon as they entered the thick vegetation. But information came in over the radio. After several minutes, Darryl found Cody's Harry Potter t-shirt and black pants. On they went, deeper into the wet woods. Then, 20 minutes after Darryl had set off, the radio crackled. Hey, we've got a visual. Nobody knew yet if it was a rescue or a recovery. Stephanie turned to her sister and the other rescue workers at the command post and said, "Go! Go get him!" The firefighters and EMTs, including Brittany, tore off down the ravine, heading for the GPS coordinates that Darryl's handlers had sent to them. After an agonizing few minutes, Stephanie heard her sister's voice over the radio. "We found him! We found him!" The tone in Van Volkenberg's voice told Stephanie that Cody was alive. He was lying face up in a temporary creek created by the rain, which had helped prevent his body from overheating. But he was severely dehydrated. One of the canine unit members, Lieutenant Virginia Stafford, slowly poured water a few drops at a time into Cody's mouth. He was looking at his rescuers, alert, but unable to speak. Cody's injuries were extensive. Lacerations and scrapes all over his body from falling and rolling down on the ravine, and bedsore-like burns on his back from lying in one position too long. The medical team would later discover that he had suffered a fracture on the right side of his head, brain trauma, pneumonia, and bacterial infections. It was no wonder that Cody hadn't called out for help or been able to extricate himself from the ravine. But his survival instincts had kicked in enough that he had crawled to a shaded area until help finally arrived. The doctors later told Stephanie that Cody probably wouldn't have survived more than another few hours alone in the woods. The fire department's rescue team secured Cody to a stretcher and carried him out of the ravine, then drove him to a nearby flight pad where he was airlifted by medical transport helicopter to Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital in St. Louis. Once in the pediatric ICU, Cody started crashing. The doctors decided the best thing for his survival odds would be to place him in a medically induced coma. For days, Stephanie and the rest of the family waited at Cody's bedside. The doctors tried to wean him off his sedation and wake him, but his body wasn't ready. Finally, after 11 days, he came out of his coma. Using a hand gesture from American Sign Language that Stephanie had taught her sons, he told his mom, "I love you." When Cody could talk again, 2 weeks after he was found, he made the sort of proclamation you'd expect from a 13-year-old boy. "Ma, I need a Coke from McDonald's." After a couple of weeks in a rehab facility, Cody returned to his home in Farmington in late August. A few weeks later, he started 8th grade at Farmington Middle School. Cody's recovery has been slow. He still has a lot of neuro challenges, Stephanie said about 3 months after the incident. He'll be having a conversation with you and then completely forget what he's talking about. Or he'll be standing there and he'll lose all muscle control. The doctors had explained that full recovery would take another 6 to 12 months. On Thursday, September 11, Cody, by then 14, traveled to the Farmington Correctional Center to thank the four-legged hero who led rescuers to where he lay in the ravine. "Hi, buddy," Cody said to Daryl in a soft, loving tone as he bent down to pet the black and brown bloodhound and affectionately scratch his neck and chin. "I was getting a little emotional myself because I have a 14-year-old, Gillum recalls. Seeing him get to meet the dog that saved him, that was pretty special." As the media picked up on Cody's story, folks from as far away as California sent Daryl dog treats. As for Cody, he says he has a new four-word mantra for when he is finally allowed to get back on his skateboard. "Keep the helmet on." And, adds his mom, "Don't leave home without your phone." That was Last Ditch Effort by Eric Raskin. And now an article from the Saturday Evening Post, from the In My Life column, by Ruth Bonapace. Lost and Found: One Woman's Struggle to Help Her Neurodivergent Brother Find Security and Independence. When I take my 69-year-old brother to lunch, I already know what he will order: steak, onion rings, and a large mug of beer. With a shy smile, he shares corny jokes with the waiter and orders a brownie sundae, which he devours with childlike glee. As I watch him relish his favorite meal, which we share about once a month, I am grateful that he is happy and safe. It wasn't always that way. Mom described Ben's birth in 1956 as traumatic, a double breech with the umbilical cord wrapped around his neck, depriving him of oxygen. He'd been heavily sedated, and the doctor chose she had been heavily sedated, and the doctor chose forceps over a C-section. She told her harrowing story many times, but rarely acknowledged her only son might have suffered lasting damage. In the 1960s, few children without extreme disabilities were classified as special needs, and there was no school intervention. No one used the term neurodivergent. When Ben was held back in the first grade, our frustrated father shouted at him while Mom stood by. Watching my little brother sobbing at the kitchen table, I felt helpless. As time passed, while his peers were joining sports teams, leaving for college, and marrying, Ben stayed home and became my father's helper. Dad, an Italian immigrant who built a cutlery service, taught Ben to sharpen knives, hoping the skill would secure his future. At 31, with a toddler on my hip and pregnant with my second child, I put it to my parents bluntly. "What's going to happen someday to Ben when you're not around?" They dismissed my concerns. A reckoning seemed a long way off. When Mom and Dad passed, Ben was on the cusp of 60, alone in their four-bedroom home. Neighbors we'd grown up with had long since gone. Sleeping in his clothes, he rarely left the house, playing video games and combing newspapers for celebrity articles, slipping further into his own world. My role as executor was clear. I had to sell the house. But what about Ben? The reverse mortgage had depleted the equity. There was no life insurance. And Dad's business had fallen into shambles after he became infirmed. I called a county caseworker. "What's his diagnosis?" she asked. "He might be on the autism spectrum, but he was never diagnosed," I said. "Is there anything you can do?" She gave me a list of agencies to call. Same questions, same results. "He's not my problem," some said. "We can't leave him on the street," I insisted. My own therapist agreed that I was not responsible. Still, I was unwilling to abandon him. The more I researched options, the more discouraged I became. The population of older adults in America with an intellectual or development disability numbers over 1 million, almost double that of 20 years ago. When parents of a special needs adult die without a plan, many become wards of the state, with an appointed guardian making life decisions. Some end up in homeless shelters or subway stations. Both possibilities were terrifying. As the closing loomed, I confided my panic to my longtime hairdresser, Kelly, who jumped into action. "I'll bet we can find a place for him," she said. We scoured listings at over 55 communities with affordable condos and went for a look. Digging into my savings, I put a deposit on a small unit. Then I rented a U-Haul and, with the help of two volunteers, moved Ben in. This way I knew he'd never be homeless. The gated community's winding paths were tranquil, and the community room with pool tables and a television was a hub of activity. But I was still uneasy. Perhaps a companion would help. After checking the pet policy, I went to a shelter and asked for a gentle, trained dog. They brought out a Yorkie mix, a bony ragamuffin with bright eyes and unruly hair. No chip, no collar, no response on Facebook. I'll take him. When I showed up with my furry surprise, Ben broke into a goofy smile and cradled him against his chest as I unpacked food and a dog bed. A week later, my brother announced he'd named the pooch Little Benny after himself. On my next visit, Ben alerted me he had to be back by 4 p.m. for Little Benny's walk. Never had I known him to be aware of time or schedules. Months later, a round furball scampered up to me. "Looks great," I said, "but he's so fat. What are you feeding him?" "Oh, just his dog food," he said, "and whatever I eat. You know, Cheerios, soup, spaghetti." As we walked Little Benny, everyone seemed to know him. Within a month, Ben landed his first real job, rounding up shopping carts part-time at a nearby store. My brother spoke of his work with pride. He paid his electric bill and bought groceries, while I covered the property taxes and the water bill. For the first time since our father died, Ben was not surrounded by boxes, and there were clean sheets on the bed. He delighted telling stories about his best friend. "Every night, Little Benny jumps on my bed," he said. "Then he goes to sleep." I tried to prepare him for the day that Little Benny, an older dog, might fail to greet him at the door. When Little Benny's health failed 3 years later, Ben called me. I could hear the fear and drove an hour to accompany him and Benny to the vet. Ben, who never cried at our parents' funerals, was stoic. I was concerned he might regress, especially after the store he'd worked at closed. But the routines and lessons he'd learned taking care of Little Benny endured. It took months, but he landed work at a movie theater, checking tickets and cleaning up. When I asked if he wanted another dog, he said Little Benny could not be replaced, and besides, he was out of the house too much to take care of a new pet. Exactly what I'd hoped would happen. On his dresser, I saw he placed a paw print and a lock of Benny's fur. That was Lost and Found by Ruth Bonapace. And now, lastly, a few pieces, short pieces, from the Glad to Hear It column. Three stories to make your day. In Stitches. Comedian Drew Lynch was doing stand-up at a comedy club in Spokane, Washington, September, when a man in the crowd collapsed from a cardiac arrest. Other audience members performed CPR until medics arrived and took the man, Dick Wendy, 83, to a nearby hospital. A shaken-up Lynch finished his set, but couldn't get the man out of his mind. So the next day, he visited Wendy in the hospital to tell him the jokes he hadn't gotten to hear, spending hours at his bedside. This was a delight for Wendy, a longtime fan of Lynch. And from that day on, the two stayed in touch, texting often. Lynch visited Wendy again months later, and when Wendy passed away on January 7, Lynch wrote on Facebook, "I will miss our friendship," signing the post, "Your foster grandson, Drew." keeping his head above water. 12-year-old Ashish Selvaraj was riding in the car with his nanny and her 2-year-old son last summer in Montgomery County, Maryland, when a flash flood swept their vehicle off the road and into an overflowing creek bed. As water rushed around them, the quick-thinking tween grabbed the toddler and climbed on top of the car, allowing the young child to breathe and rescue crews to see where they were. The car was totally submerged and practically invisible in the deluge by the time firefighters reached them. After bringing all three of them back to dry land, the firefighters called Ashish a hero. His parents felt so grateful to the first responders that they showed up at the firehouse days later with a check for $10,000. A special arrangement. The somber notes of taps are played at every funeral that includes military honors. But those notes often emerge from a device playing from an official recording instead of from a live instrument. Two nationwide nonprofits, Bugles Across America and Taps for Veterans, match volunteer horn players with events that could use their services. Matthew Burford is one such volunteer, and he has driven more than 100 miles from his home in Alabama to play taps live. "It's not like I don't like the recording," Burford told the New York Times. "I just feel like our veterans and our soldiers deserve better." We've run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.